Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Education Channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is James Friedel. James Friedel is Associate Professor in the Department of English at The Ohio State University. The recipient of multiple awards for his work in rhetorical theory and history, Friedel is the author in 2006 of Rhetorical Action in Ancient Athens, Persuasive Artistry from Solon to Demosthenes, and now The Enthymeme, Syllogism, Reasoning, and Narrative in Ancient Greek Rhetoric. In The Enthymeme, Friedel argues that our taken-for-granted understanding of the enthymeme is based on centuries of misreadings dating back to Aristotle. Friedel excavates these layers of misunderstandings in our understanding of this key concept in rhetorical theory to uncover not only a more accurate theory of the enthymeme, but to potentially a more useful one. Jim Friedel, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks, Tom.
In my introduction, I described something called a taken-for-granted understanding of the enthymeme. Now, I've had the privilege of reviewing your book for the International Journal of Communication, and I was describing it to some departmental colleagues that included folks both in communication and in journalism. And one of those, someone in journalism, asked, what exactly is an enthymeme? That is, what are you communication people talking about? I suspect that many of our listeners might be likewise perplexed, so I thought we should begin with you telling us, what is an enthymeme, at least as it is commonly used by teachers of speech, composition, and logic?
Right. So that's very common to hear people say, what is an enthymeme? If you're outside the field, the fields that you just mentioned, you've probably never encountered the term. And honestly, when people learn about the enthymeme in rhetoric classes, usually graduate study rhetoric classes, it's new to them, and it's a temporary thing. It doesn't get a lot of attention outside of that. So an enthymeme is based on Aristotle, as it is widely understood, is a unit of reasoning, a unit of logic that is based on a syllogism. And as many people know, a syllogism is a unit of three-part unit of reasoning that has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. So if I say all robins are birds and all birds fly, then I can conclude that all robins fly. And if you put the pieces together correctly, and if the premises are true, then the conclusion has to be true. And so it's useful, says Aristotle, if you put your propositions into the form of a syllogism in the correct way, you can learn new things, build knowledge, or test the knowledge that you have to see if what you think is true is actually true. And it seems that in Aristotle's Rhetoric, the treatise that he wrote on the field of rhetoric, it seems that he says that an enthymeme is a syllogism, but with one of the premises missing. So if I say, instead of saying all robins are birds and all birds fly, I can simply say all birds fly, therefore robins fly. And you can follow along because you already know the other premise that all birds fly or that all birds are mammals. I don't have to tell you that. So apparently, says the tradition from Aristotle, the enthymeme is a rhetorical syllogism, number one, because it's briefer, so we don't bore our listeners and we don't tell them things they already know. And secondly, and more importantly, it requires the audience to add in the missing premise, as it were, so they become participants in the argument. And it's thought that if the audience is a participant in the argument, it will be more persuasive because they're helping to build the very piece of reasoning that they are asked to agree with. So that's basically what an enthymeme is. It's a short syllogism.
Yeah, or as you call it in the book, a truncated syllogism.
Right, that's the common way to describe it.
Right. So I'm wondering, just out of curiosity, what got you interested, and before we sort of delve into why that taken-for-granted description that you just offered of the syllogism is essentially mistaken, what got you interested in an in-depth study of the enthymeme?
Several things. One of the most important ones, I think, is the fact that for me, and I think in rhetoric, the field of rhetoric attempts to describe how language works in practice, how texts work on people, in terms of what they think, in terms of what they feel, in terms of the moral decisions that they make, in terms of what they imagine, what they think is true. And many rhetorical terms have immediate experiential resonance. So one rhetorical concept is ethos. And ethos is the idea that when we read a text, we get an image of the author in the text, and we gauge our sense of the text's persuasiveness in part on the credibility of the author. And everybody does this. We see a text, and based on who we think wrote it, we make decisions about how persuasive it is. And I have lots of experiential resonance with that. That rings true to me. That happens to me.
Absolutely.
When I read a text, I get an image of the author. The enthymeme, on the other hand, I was baffled by, even when I first learned about it as a graduate student, the idea that people write enthymemes by writing syllogisms and then taking out a premise, or the idea that audiences hear enthymemes as syllogisms with a premise missing. I never remember doing that. I had no experience with that, encountering any texts that I've ever read. And it was always a kind of orphan, like a theoretical orphan in my mind. And so that one of the things that led me back to that was that sense of frustration that such a basic feature of rhetorical theory, and it is considered a fairly basic feature of rhetorical theory as a piece of how texts introduce reasoning and how reasoning works to persuade people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That seemed like a glaring omission to me. So that was one of the first steps, and there are others, but that was a big one.
Very good. So as you said, as your book lays out, we begin with this idea, the understanding of the enthymeme that you just described, and you call that enthymeme 3.0, the truncated syllogism. So what are some of the problems there?
Aside
from the one that you just mentioned, I guess, right at the beginning, is that you never found yourself actually writing one.
So there are several problems. One of the problems is the notion that by dropping a premise, we change something about what the syllogism is. And many scholars have said, you know, dropping a premise changes nothing about the logical structure of the syllogism. It's essentially the same thing, whether we have all the premises stated or not. The kind of inference that you're making, the kind of reasoning that you're doing is the same, whether it's a syllogism or an enthymeme. A more serious problem is that, for me, a careful reading of Aristotle, suggests that that's not how he described the enthymeme. And I should say that that version of the enthymeme comes entirely from Aristotle. And it's not just me, it's many scholars before me, Jeffrey Walker and Bernie Eade and other both rhetoric scholars and classic scholars, through a careful reading of Aristotle, have said that that's not how he describes the enthymeme. It's a misreading of Aristotle. And I can go into more detail about why that is.
Sure.
But that's a big problem. The third problem is that, as I argue in my book, when I think about that model of the enthymeme and when I try to make that work in texts, in written texts, I just don't think it's a very good description of how rational persuasion works. And I think that is in part because Aristotle never suggested that the syllogism was something that people write when they're making arguments. The syllogism for him was a logical structure that you could use to analyze an argument to see whether it was valid or not and to understand how the steps were put together. So thinking about it as something that we produce in natural language interactions, that's a big stretch. Aristotle never understood or represented syllogisms to be that kind of thing.
But somehow that misreading became sort of the standard way that, again, you know, this is how it's taught in public speaking classes. This is certainly how it's taught in composition, I think.
Right.
Why do you suspect, or I know that you know this, but why does that happen?
Well, in part it happens because there's several pieces to that. In part, it's because there are places in Aristotle where it sounds like that's what he's saying. He does say that enthymemes in rhetoric tend to be shorter than the term that he uses is syllogismos, the Greek term that we translate as syllogism. He says rhetorical arguments are shorter than syllogismos. And he says when you're making an argument in rhetoric, in a legal speech or a political speech, you don't have to say everything if the audience already knows it. And so if you translate syllogismos as syllogism and you say with Aristotle that enthymemes can be shorter than those and that certain things you don't have to say if the audience already knows it, the conclusion seems to be that if it's a three-premise syllogism and the entheme is shorter, the only way to make it shorter is by dropping one. You certainly can't drop two, otherwise you just have one proposition, so you just drop one. So there is language in Aristotle with sufficient misunderstanding that you can construe as an entheme. So that's one part of the answer.
Yeah. So and then in addition, you suggest in the introduction to your book this metaphor that you use of the city of dialectic and the surrounding, maybe a neighboring polis of rhetoric or a neighboring polis of narrative. And that seems to play into this more deliberate, not simply a misunderstanding, but sort of almost a deliberate misrepresentation, I would think, of what we understand today as an enthymeme.
Deliberate. Can you say more about that? Deliberate how?
Well, in the sense of in order to become more like dialectic, rhetoric had to essentially sort of ape some of the techniques of dialectic.
Right. And
in order to, you know, in order to get some sort of legitimacy.
Right. Yes. So if we think of dialectic as the art of reasoning, and Aristotle, you know, has a treatise called The Topics where he talks about dialectic as an art of reasoning, about one individual questioning another individual about a proposition to determine whether the proposition is true or not. And the questions and answers go back and forth until the respondent either contradicts himself or is unable to answer. And in either of those cases, you can determine whether the proposition was true or not. So that was Aristotle's forte. That was what he taught. And when he wrote his treatise on rhetoric, he essentially said that rhetoric is basically like dialectic. He called it the antistrophe of dialectic, which is often translated as the counterpart of dialectic. Right. So that fundamental metaphor, that fundamental comparison, because of the popularity of Aristotle in the 20th century, when departments of speech and departments of English and composition turned to rhetoric to inform training in speech and composition, they largely turned to Aristotle. And so Aristotle's dialectical view of rhetoric took hold and dominated the conversation. So the comparison between the enthymeme and the syllogism, which was already incorrect, became part of that comparison, became part of that conversation. And Aristotle was so popular that it was very, very difficult to get away from it. And I think the attraction of for people in rhetoric of having their own version of the syllogism, their own sort of a rhetorical model of reasoning, was very attractive. It's very teachable. It's very reproducible. I say in the book that I think it's just sufficiently difficult for teachers and students to appreciate it, and simple enough that most people can grab it and sort of be charmed by its uniqueness and clarity within a class period or two. And so that's why I said at the beginning of the interview, people tend to teach it in argument classes, in composition classes, in logic classes, in graduate classes in the history of rhetoric. You learn the enthymeme, but it's the kind of thing that you learn and then you just sort of move on. It rarely receives sustained attention.
Because in that form, it's almost, as you said, it's almost impossible to reproduce. And you know, as I wrote in the review that I did, I don't know that I have ever heard an enthymeme when, you know, after introducing it, I don't know that I've ever seen anyone able to reproduce it.
Right.
So this moves us along, I think, to what you describe as enthymeme 2.0, right? So if right. 3.0 is the truncated version, as it's commonly taught in composition and speech classes, then 2.0 is Aristotle's kind of misreading, right?
Right. So you want me to talk about Aristotle's
misreading?
So Aristotle calls the enthymeme syllogismos. Syllogismos is translated as syllogism. It doesn't really mean syllogism for Aristotle, particularly not when he's talking about either dialectic or rhetoric. It just means deduction. And actually it means more basically, if we think about deduction as a particular type of reasoning, syllogismos is broader than that. It really just means reasoning. And his definitions make it sound like what we would call an inference. He says, if something is true, something else follows. Like if an audience hears a statement that's true or a series of statements that are true, they think something else is true in addition. And he says, that's syllogismos. And it, as you can probably hear, that's a pretty broad definition. And that's the definition that he starts from. So There are problems with 3.0 in thinking about the truncated syllogism, because Aristotle was never talking about syllogisms. The problem with 2.0 is that Aristotle is, when he said that rhetoric was the antistrophe of dialectic, it really does seem that he's thinking of dialectic throughout much of his treatise. So part of the process of studying dialectic involves studying what he calls the topics. And the topics are what he would refer to as forms of reasoning or heads of argument. So for example, he says, there is the argument from contraries. So if you have four terms, A, B, C, and D, and A is the opposite of B, and A is related to C, then D will be the opposite of C. So for example, if if temperance or the ability to resist temptation is a good thing, then the lack of temperance, the inability to resist temptation, is the bad thing. So if good is the opposite of bad, then temperance will be the opposite of the lack of temperance. And he says, you know, if you're constructing an argument, look and see, and there are contraries involved, look and see whether, you know, the one set of contraries can be clarified by tying them to another set of contraries. So that's one of the forms. And he has many forms in the topics, and he does the exact same thing in the rhetoric. And many of the topics in the rhetoric are practically identical to the topics in the dialectic. So he's thinking throughout his rhetorical treatise of rhetoric in terms of dialectic. The problem is that when you read rhetorical speeches, and when rhetoric was being invented by Aristotle and other early treatise writers, when they were talking about rhetoric, they were talking mostly about legal speeches, legal arguments in courts, and political speeches in assembly, where people were drawing up policy and deciding, making policy decisions, and a few other sort of ceremonial genres like funeral orations and games and contests and things like that. We can focus mostly on legal arguments because that's where rhetoric was mostly applied. If you read legal cases, it's very difficult to pinpoint an enthymeme. And much of what forms the substance of the legal case is the legal story about what happened and how it applies to the law. And much of the decisions that people make and much of the persuasive effect of the legal speech really stems from that story, the two competing stories that are given between the two sides of the legal case, the plaintiff and the defendant, or the prosecutor and the defendant. So that, you know, when I said at the beginning that I didn't encounter enthymemes, it wasn't part of my experience, I think that especially applies to reading ancient legal cases. And we have about 200 or so, both political but mostly legal speeches from ancient oratory, from the 10 Attic orators. And when you read those speeches, what you're really struck by is how much depends on the story and how difficult it is to find the kind of dialectical enthymeme that Aristotle's talking about. So I think one of his biggest problems is that dialectical framework really limited how he understood the kinds of inferences that people are making and that they're leading audiences to make when they're delivering legal speeches. So that's one big problem that Aristotle has, is his dialectic, his decision to frame rhetoric in terms of dialectic. It did a tremendous favor to rhetoric by establishing it as a kind of reasoning. So if we go back a few years before Aristotle, Plato has very harsh things to say about rhetoric. In several of his dialogues, he claims that there is no such thing as rhetorical reasoning. There is philosophical reasoning, and if you do philosophical reasoning and learn the truth about a topic, that's really all you need to know. Rhetoric doesn't really have anything to add to that other than flattery and obfuscation. And so Aristotle seemed to do rhetoric a favor by saying, rhetoric does produce a kind of knowledge. It's not certain knowledge. It's not scientific knowledge. It's probable knowledge. But it is a kind of knowledge, and it does have its own kind of reasoning. And that kind of reasoning is called the enthymeme. And here's how it's like dialectic and blah, blah, blah. And so for teachers of rhetoric and composition and speech and communication, that seemed to be a very powerful and supportive theoretical framework for resuscitating rhetoric as a legitimate discipline. And it did that. It sustained rhetoric, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it was probably part of the reason why Aristotle was chosen as one of the champions of rhetoric in the 20th century. But I think it comes at a tremendous cost. It seriously distorts how people actually argue with each other and attempt to persuade each other in living rhetorical encounters.
this seems like a good place to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some of those issues that you just brought up about the, you know, some of the damage that that conceptualization of the enthymeme has produced for us. So we're going to take a short break. I'm going to remind everyone that this is the education channel of the New Books Network.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And welcome back. I'm Tom DeSena on the New Books Network, and we're continuing our discussion with Jim Friedel about his latest book, The Enthymeme, Syllogism, Reasoning, and Narrative in Ancient Greek Rhetoric. Just before the break, you mentioned that Aristotle's, essentially tries to salvage rhetoric by saying that it is a counterpart to dialectic and saying it has these sort of reasoning-like features to it, but that ultimately that it does a disservice to the work that rhetoric does. And so I think this is probably a good point to talk about what you describe as the enthymeme 1.0. And I wonder if you might want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so having no experience with enthymeme 3.0, the truncated syllogism, I talked about how it didn't resonate with me experientially in my encounter with texts and in my production of arguments. And as I became more confident in my questioning of Aristotle's version of the enthymeme and the inadequacy, and most of this came from reading legal arguments, ancient legal arguments, and contemporary legal arguments, I decided to start over. And one of the things that led me to start over was in the process of reading legal arguments from the ancient world. They're quite diverse. They're quite entertaining. I came upon increasingly frequently, it's sort of like once you decide to purchase a certain kind of car and you start to notice that car everywhere on the road.
Sure, absolutely.
Once I saw this phenomenon in the ancient orders, I began to see it very frequently. And that is the ancient orders, they never use the term enthymeme. It's almost strictly a theoretical term. And other theoretical treatise writers from the ancient world use that term, the noun, enthymeme, to describe that logical, what Aristotle would say is a logical structure. The orders never use the term. However, they do use a verb form of the term enthymema, which I translate as enthymize, very, very frequently. And that verb, to enthymize, has a range of meanings that includes to think about something, to consider something, to pay attention to something, like in a legal speech, to pay attention to a detail, a narrative detail. Maybe to pay attention to a narrative detail that my opposing speaker has mentioned. And in many cases, in the context of the speech, it becomes clear that when the orator says, pay attention, gentlemen of the jury, or just think for a minute, gentlemen of the jury, using that verb, enthymize, what they're asking the jury to do is to understand the significance of a piece of narrative, of a detail from the legal narrative. remember, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that when his grandfather asked his nephews to bring the magistrate to the house, they refused to do so. And when a magistrate did stop by at the house, they refused to let him enter. That reminding the jury of that detail prompts them to think about what that detail means. In this case, it would be a motive. Why would they turn the magistrate away? So they use this verb over and over and over again to call the audience's attention to a narrative detail that they want the audience to interpret properly, to realize the significance of it. I didn't at first make any connection between the use of that verb and the use of the noun enthymeme. But once I saw the connection, I immediately felt that I was onto something, that there was some connection here between how the orators were using the verb enthymize and how Aristotle and other treatise writers were using the verb enthymeme.
And so you found this, this verb form in a variety of different legal arguments from ancient Greek oratory.
Right.
Which brings us to I don't know if you want to talk a little bit in particular about Lysias.
Sure. Generally, or do you want me to jump into Lysias' enthymemes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Lysias is very well known. He was a hugely prolific speechwriter in the ancient world. He was considered one of the masters of his time in the ancient world. He lived before Demosthenes, and Demosthenes has eclipsed Lysias as probably the best known legal orator. But in his time, Lysias was probably one of the best known and most prolific speechwriters of his time. So he taught rhetoric, probably, but he's better known as a speechwriter. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of speeches for clients. He was paid to do so. And his many of his speeches, not all of them, only actually a small portion of them, but still a fairly large number of speeches have come down to us that he wrote. And so I focus in the book on one of his speeches. It's actually the first one. It's numbered. All of the Attic Orders speeches are numbered. And this is his the first speech, Lysias 1. Lysias 1 is a speech about an adultery case, a man who kills an adulterer who has slept with his wife. The law says that if a man catches the adulterer red-handed, he can do what he wishes with him. And that's interpreted to mean anything from taking him to court, to demanding payment or ransom, to killing him. And there's another law, a justifiable homicide law, that stipulates that, that says, you know, if you accidentally kill somebody in war, or if you are set upon by a robber and kill them in self-defense, or if you're in an athletic game and you accidentally kill someone in boxing or wrestling, or if someone you catch someone on top of your wife, it's justifiable to kill them. You can't be prosecuted as a homicide for that. So this man, Euphiletus, kills the adulterer who he catches sleeping with his wife, Eratosthenes, and Eratosthenes' relatives bring him to trial for murder. So the question is, was this an example of him catching his wife in the process, or was this a case of premeditated murder? And it wasn't lost on the ancients that you could kill somebody and use one of the forms of justifiable homicide to excuse your killing. So the question is whether this legitimately was a case that fell under these two legal tools, these two legal forms. The problem was for Euphiletus that he did have some advanced knowledge of his wife's affair. First, there were many clues that the wife left about the affair. She
It's an entertaining portion of the book, I should say.
It's a very entertaining speech. When his wife's child was born, he flipped his house upside down. In Greek houses, the male's room was on the bottom floor, so that it was easy of access, and that's where men would gather to drink and chat and play instruments and sing poetry and have, you know, girls and boys that they could entertain them. It was an entertaining room. Those are the men's quarters. The women's quarters were upstairs, and one of the purposes of that was to keep access to women difficult. Athenian men and Greek men in particular were a little paranoid about their wives and other females of the household gaining access to the outside world, and unrelated men gaining access to them. So women slept upstairs. Their looms were upstairs, and they took care of the babies upstairs. Well, this gentleman, Euphiletus, says, when my baby was born, I flipped my house upside down so that my wife wouldn't fall down the stairs when she had to go feed the baby. I was worried that she would hurt herself, so I put the women's room downstairs and I put the men's room upstairs. This is an important detail, and this is a case where if we don't remember it, this detail can make a big difference. So this is something that he tells us at the very beginning. Well, sure enough, he's upstairs in his room, which the men's room, which is now upstairs, and his wife comes up there after he comes home from the country working on the farm, and she comes up to the bedroom, and they're playing around together up there. And he's ready to go to sleep, and she teases him by locking the door. And she says, you just want to have a go at the slave girl, at the servant girl. And he laughs about it, and she locks him in, and he thinks nothing of it. But when he wakes up the next morning, he recalls that he heard the door outside courtyard door creaking at night. And when he comes downstairs, he notices that she has makeup on, and he thinks nothing of it. He's a trusting sort. And you can see how when narrative details are introduced, they lead to inferences. And I don't have much doubt that when Lysias wrote this, he intended the audience to realize, to enthymize what the wife is doing. And also to enthymize that the husband is rather foolish, rather naive. He doesn't see what's going on. When I teach the class, we talk about this. Why would Lysias want to portray a character this way? And my students always immediately understand the answer, and it goes back to the concept I talked about earlier, ethos. When we read a text, we attribute characteristics to the author of the text based on what they say. And the audience of my class recognize that if Euphiletus appears foolish enough not to recognize that his wife is having an affair, he won't seem smart enough to have planned this murder. So that's the first moment. That's one of the moments where Lysias says, through Euphiletus, I didn't enthymize anything. I didn't realize anything that was going on. I had no suspicions. Right. So a few days later, Lysias is going about his business, and an old woman comes up to him in the marketplace and says, a man is having an affair with your wife. He ruined our household as well. He slept with the woman that I work for, and now she's jealous because he's sleeping with your wife, and you better go home and take care of things. And that, for the second time, in the very middle of this narrative, Euphiletus says, I suddenly realized everything. And he uses that verb, enthymize. I suddenly enthymized everything. My wife wore makeup. The door creaked at night. She locked me in. I need to verify this.
So all the pieces fell into place.
All the pieces fell into place. And that, I can tell you, it's a very powerful moment in the narrative. And it's a common feature of narratives for an author to place clues. And it's part of the creative skill that is required of good narrative writing to sprinkle clues throughout the narrative that all connect together to form a picture that for most audience members, while they are reading them, they don't understand the significance of the clues. They don't see how they all fall together to form the picture, so that when the author pulls the string and all the pieces fall into place, there's that wonderful moment of clarity, that aha moment. Now, I think for most of the audience, we already sort of see that. We know that she's having an affair, but we get to experience that vicariously through Euphiletus. We watch him in his aha moment. And as I say in the book, this is very similar to what Aristotle talks about in the Poetics, about the tragic plot, where towards the middle or towards the end of the play, the hero, the protagonist, realizes that everything that's been going on, it's the moment when Oedipus discovers all at once that the man that he killed is his father, and the woman that he married is his mother, and that they are the king and queen, and that he, his fate, the fate that has been predicted for him, has come true, and it all falls into place. That, you know, that moment of clarity that Aristotle calls agnerosis is very similar to what Lysias achieves here, this discovery. So he goes to his serving girl and he questions her, and she confirms it after he tells her that he already knows what happened. And she says, yes, this is what happened. And the wife told me to do this, and I've been the intermediary between him and her. And so he says, I'm not going to do anything until I know for sure. I want to see them in action before I do anything. And sure enough, the adulterer comes back, and the serving girl runs to him and says, he's in the house and you better take care of it. And he goes out and goes out to gather some neighbors. He wants some assistance to confront this man, and they gather torches in the process. And then he comes back to the house and confronts him and slays him. So that's the end of the narrative. After the narrative is where he does a little bit more explicit enthymizing. And this is where he says, for example, he says, remember, ladies and gentlemen, when I was telling my story, I said that I had to go out and get some assistance from the neighbors. But in fact, many of my neighbors were not home, and some of them were not even in the city. And so I had some difficulty finding people. But he says, just think, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, just think about it for a second. And he uses the verb enthymize. If I had planned this, wouldn't I make sure that I had some neighbors home who could assist me? Wouldn't I tell them beforehand so that I could go quickly gather them to assist me? I didn't even know if I'd be able to find anybody. Does that sound like someone who planned everything out? And so there's a little narrative detail. I went out to people's houses to gather assistance.
Not knowing that they were even going to be there.
And I didn't even know if they were going to be home or not. Why didn't I know? Because I didn't plan this out. There was no premeditation. So you can see how the narrative detail that is told in the story portion and that is directly related to the legal question gets enthymized later so that the audience can have another one of these little aha moments. Like, that proves it, that demonstrates it. And he has a few other examples of narrative details where he does that. Now, what's interesting is that he uses this verb, enthymizing, in each of those examples. He uses it to describe what he didn't realize his wife was doing. He uses it to describe the aha moment when the serving girl reveals it to him. And here again, he uses it at the end when he wants his audience to realize something that they need to see correctly in order to interpret the law as it relates to his case. And I thought to myself, I don't think that's a coincidence that he uses the exact same term once at the beginning of his speech, once in the middle of the story, the exact middle of the story, and once at the end of the speech where he's reminding the audience of which facts to pay attention to. That seemed like a deliberate move to me. There's a progression there that I talk about in the book in terms of how the enthymizing works, that made me think he might be doing something deliberate. And that is significant because of the fact that most scholars in the scholarly tradition suggests that the enthymeme was invented by theory, by theorists, and specifically that the enthymeme was invented by Aristotle. That this idea that you could use deduction to lead people to a conclusion through reasoning, that of course Aristotle would be the one to introduce that. Aristotle would be the one to formalize inference making as a rhetorical tool. And if this is true, if Lysias was doing this deliberately, then he was thinking about enthymizing as what I would call a techne, as an artistic tool. He wasn't doing it randomly. It wasn't just a colloquial form of writing speeches, but it was based on practice and based on his developing artistic abilities. This was a repeatable technique that he could use when he wanted to, and I would say that he could teach his students to use. And that would mean that people were theorizing about, if not the enthymeme, they were theorizing about enthymizing long before Aristotle used the term and explained what it meant in terms of dialectic.
As I said, this is a terrific book. I reviewed it last fall. I did not teach public speaking in the winter, but I'm going to be doing it in the summer. And I'm curious, what impact? I think your idea of enthymizing is such an enlarged idea from what is traditionally taught as the enthymeme. I'm curious as to whether you think, or what impact it might have on our practice of teaching speech or composition today.
Oh, you know, my first book, I also talk about Aristotle, and I also talk about what's wrong with Aristotle. A lot of it has to do with...
It hasn't made a difference.
Has made no difference. It had absolutely zero impact. I talk in the first book about the practice of ancient oratory and how it was performative. It was delivered, and you're standing in front of a crowd of 500 to 1,000. You know, these are large juries. It wasn't
or on a Zoom screen today.
Well, you're right. It's not a Zoom screen. It's not a courtroom with 12 people. It's an open air auditorium with 500 to 1,000, you know, or more people. And these are amateurs, and they're facing scary situations.
Life or death. Yeah.
Right. Life or death, or bankruptcy or exile.
Sure.
And they don't have any speaking experience. So the physical quality of that kind of oratory, I think, is lost if you just read about it through the theorist. So that was the sum and substance of my first book. And I remember getting a question when I was interviewing for my first job that was very much like that. Like, what impact do you think this will have? And it wasn't much. So I really don't know whether this is going to be persuasive to other rhetoric scholars or Aristotle scholars or scholars of ancient history. My primary audience is rhetoric. I think that it's a serious mistake to teach the history of rhetoric or to teach rhetorical theory and not talk about narrative and not talk about narrative reasoning. When I define the enthymeme 1.0, or what I'm calling enthymizing, I really talk about it as an example of narrative reasoning. And I think the fundamental way that we make arguments to each other, certainly in the legal sphere, and this has been a big movement in legal studies towards narrative, so much of what happens is based on storytelling, and even the parts of the argument, parts of ancient and contemporary legal speeches, and I would say other arguments, most kinds of arguments, at their core have some kind of story. I think it's almost impossible to get away from that. So I think it's a mistake not to begin teaching rhetorical theory and rhetorical practice and the history of rhetoric from the perspective of storytelling and from the perspective of narrative reasoning. Whether that catches on, I don't know. But for me, I'll say it has a lot more experiential familiarity. When I hear people arguing and I hear them telling stories and building their arguments off of stories, I think it's the most natural thing in the world for us to do. So I don't know. I don't know how much of an impact this is going to have.
Well, if it means anything at all, it certainly had an impact on me. I'm doing some serious rethinking about how I approach a speech class coming this summer. I think the book is terrific. I want to ask one last thing, which is what's next? What are you working on now?
So because of this book, I've begun to read more scholarship and argumentation. It's a huge field. It's very daunting. It's not my expertise. I've spent most of my time doing rhetorical theory and ancient rhetorical theory. But the idea of narrative reasoning, I just find very compelling. And I don't find much out there about narrative as a form of argument. And in fact, there's traditions within the study of legal argumentation and within the study of argumentation itself that draws a pretty stark distinction between what you're doing when you're telling a story and what you're doing when you're making an argument. And most representations of argument either don't talk about narrative at all, or if they do talk about narrative, they talk about it as possibly a precursor to argument, or more commonly, the sort of alternative to argument, the other of argument. Many scholars, Jerome Bruner is one of them, Fisher is another within the field of rhetoric, who basically say, you know, there's really two kinds of texts in the world. There's stories and there's arguments. There's two kinds of rationality in the world. There's narrative and there's argument, and they are work differently and they are different. And when you want to persuade someone through reasoning, you do it through argument. When you want to persuade someone through images and emotions, you tell stories. But this book has shown me a lot of examples where when we read stories, we make inferences, and the inferences that we make are based on facts that are stated. And if Aristotle's definition of syllogismos is when you hear something stated, or when you hear some things stated, you think of something else, I think to myself, that happens in narrative all the time. I don't think I've ever read a narrative where I haven't been drawing conclusions about actions, about characters, about motives, about relationships, about outcomes. And yet, when people in argument talk about reasoning and making inferences, they just don't talk about narrative. So my next project is really an attempt to describe narrative as a form of argument. And specifically within rhetoric, the term is logos. Ethos is the appeal to character. Pathos is the appeal to emotion. Logos is the appeal to reason or rationality. Logos in rhetoric is treated as argument. And my next project is to say logos is narrative before it can be argument. The people have to make inferences about the story that you're telling before they can understand the argument that you're making. So that's my next project.
Well, I'm going to look forward to reading that when you get it done. Jim Friedel, thank you for your time today. And of course, for all of the work that went into this excellent book. Once again, The Enthymeme, Syllogism, Reasoning, and Narrative in Ancient Greek Rhetoric, published by the Pennsylvania State University Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and this is the Education Channel of the New Books Network. Thank you for joining us.